I grew up in the Mormon Church. Born and raised, as they say. Even during the times of inactivity, I still considered myself to be a true believing Mormon. Times and people change, and when someone pushes you to reevaluate your beliefs, you sometimes realize how wrong you were. 2016 was the year I moved from Mormonville to Heathensburg. I'm Molly Ann Mormon. Welcome to Doubting Dogma, where I explore my new views and new friendships, moving on without religious belief. All right. Well, welcome back to Doubting Dogma, everybody. I'm Molly Ann Mormon, and joining me today is someone who messaged me and said, would you want to talk? And I'm like, heck yeah. So joining me from Australia, the other side of the world, is John. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, absolutely. So you had said you grew up in the Mormon Church, right?
That's right.
You were born and raised and all that.
Born and raised, multiple generations. Found me all the way back to covered wagons and polygamists and the whole shooting match.
Yeah, I know. I've got some family that came across the plains as well, because my aunt used to say stuff about, well, we could join the Daughters of Pioneers if we wanted to. And we're just like, yeah, no, I'm good. That's such elitist Mormonist stuff. It's ridiculous. But, well, first, I want to know, so how did you end up in Australia if you grew up here in the U.S.? Oh,
that is a long story. And, you know, it's connected to everything. And it involves the usual reasons that people end up in Australia, you know, betrayal and broken promises and those. The usual.
They're being sent to the prison colony.
Yeah.
Okay.
I essentially ended up stuck out here many years ago with my ex-wife because she wanted to move here. She was originally from here, wanted to come back and work.
Okay.
And then that, you know, all went to shit. So, yeah, but, you know, the interesting thing is through all that, I stuck with the church thick and thin, right the way through. And it was only much later after that that I started realizing that, hey, none of this makes sense. It actually doesn't make any sense. It took me 50 years to figure it out. And what I find really interesting looking back on it is how does somebody, you know, and I'm a scientist, you know, how does somebody with that training, that background, someone who's reasonably intelligent and skeptical and rational-minded, how does somebody stay in the world's craziest religion for 50 years without figuring it out sooner?
Yeah, I know growing up, I had such cognitive dissonance with science and everything. And, I mean, I didn't even think about it. I just compartmentalized everything and just, when I was at school, it was this way. But when I was at home in church, it was this way, you know. And so it's just really weird having that thought process and not thinking anything of it.
I think I did think about it quite a bit. But I put it down to sort of two sides of the equation. One is motivated reasoning, having a really good reason to want to find a way to make it all compatible in your mind. And then the other is special pleading, finding that you don't hold your religious beliefs to the same standards that you would hold all your other beliefs about things like health claims or science or UFOs or Bigfoot. And they get special treatment.
Oh, definitely. All right. So grew up in the Mormon Church and over there in Utah or what?
Well, my family was from Utah, but we were living in Arizona. I grew up in Arizona. So, yeah, mission, the whole nine yards, temple marriage.
Oh, you went on your mission?
Yeah, went on a mission.
Where'd you go?
I went to Zurich.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, spoke German, have German ancestry, so had a little bit of German previously.
Okay.
I still speak German now. Not very often. You don't get much call for it in Australia.
Yeah, I always wanted to learn German. And I bowled with some Germans for years back in El Paso.
Mm.
And there were certain phrases I could pick up, but I never learned any of it, which is quite a pity, because I was around him for years. But yeah. There was one little phrase they'd use, like if they got a split and they hit one of them, there was a phrase that meant one for the team. And so if I heard it, I'd recognize it, but he can't say it, which is funny. But all right. So how was it on your mission? Like, was it one of these spiritual experiences and you felt like super close to God and the church, or did you have any of that cognitive dissonance at the time?
The mission was really tough for me. And the problem was that I'm kind of an introvert, and I could actually see things from other people's perspective. And I thought, you know, we're just...
I can definitely relate to the introvert.
You know, we're bothering people here at their homes. I feel really uncomfortable doing this. You know, I was really convinced. You know, I was a converted Mormon, you know. And I had the whole testimony thing and everything. But I just felt like I wasn't a very good missionary because I wasn't an outgoing person. And I didn't actually... I only realized this years later, I didn't actually care about other people's problems so much, because for the most part, these are problems that have all been solved and they didn't interest me. that seems like kind of a sociopathic thing to say, but my compassion extends to trying to help people with new problems that nobody's had before and finding answers to them, right? That's kind of why I went into science. That curiosity took me there.
The problem solving, you want to get your hands dirty and go in there and find new stuff.
Yeah, new things. Not the same old problem that's already been solved, for which we already know the solutions.
Okay. Well, that does make sense, at least to me, in my little mind. So.
Yeah, so the mission was really hard for me, and I wasn't that good at it. I didn't like it, and I was really glad to get home and get back into school.
Was there a big culture shock when you were over there? Like, how different is it? Because I've never been to Germany. That's one of the places I would love to go.
Yeah, well, it's great places to visit. But you do have to be prepared to have your world sort of turned upside down, because culture shock is a real thing. And I saw it happen with a lot of my companions who had never left their hometown. I'd traveled a bit, and I'd lived in Germany before. You know, as a teenager, we were there for a year. I spoke a little bit German. I was accustomed to going to sort of new places, finding new foods, and seeing that, these are just as good as the foods we have. They're different, and the customs are different, and the way people do things is different, right down to the way that you wash dishes in the kitchen. There's differences in the way people do that from place to place. And a lot of these teenage American kids go over there and just really freak out. No, the way we do everything is better back in America, and we have better food and everything is better there, and don't like all this. This is, you know, all these people do everything the wrong way. So I saw that a lot, but personally, I was just able to observe it, and I kind of enjoyed it. I liked being in Germany and Switzerland. I felt really at home there. I just didn't like knocking on people's doors and talking to people about something that I considered really personal and none of my business, for, you know, what religion they had or what beliefs they had. So it was uncomfortable for me.
Yeah, I remember when I was in Young Women's, we had an activity or something. We went on splits with the missionaries. Sure. And so we were out there knocking on doors in our own neighborhood, getting doors slammed in our faces. And Oh, I hated it. It's just so uncomfortable going up to somebody and, yeah, let me tell you about, I'm not interested, you know. And
I don't know why we do it either. It's the least effective means of persuading. And now I look back on it and kind of cringe a bit. I can't believe I did that. No.
They always have those different stories, you know. And we tracked it through this whole neighborhood and everybody was slamming their doors, but we said, no, we got to go on. And then the next house, they invited us in, and so it was all worth it. Now, no, thank you.
Yeah. So, well, I think if that ever happened to me, you see, I never, you know, had any success whatsoever on the mission. I'm kind of glad now that I didn't. Because yeah. I probably feel worse today for having brought someone into the church than I did at the time for not having brought anyone into the church.
Yeah, I can. Yeah, I can see that. Because I know just recently, last week, I guested on, what was it? Everyone's Agnostic. And Cass Midgley, one of the hosts, he was, I guess he was a preacher for years and years. And in some of the past episodes, he had said he still feels so bad about all the people that he had brought in. But I guess he's encountered some of them that he had brought into religion, and they've all, well, not all of them, but some of them had left, and he was like, I'm so relieved, you know. So,
but there's an interesting thing about those kinds of feelings, guilt and remorse. Those are a lot of the emotions that keep people in religion in the first place, and that keeps them coming back.
Yeah.
And it's offered to us as sort of, you know, this is the cure for, you know, how bad you're feeling. But I never felt any better. I never felt any relief of guilt doing any of the things that the church taught to do. And I never felt any of that relief until much later in life, a few years ago. I had a bit of a crisis that I went through that I had to find a way to sort of manage my emotions. It was either that or leave, right? Because this was a really terrible situation. I had zero control over it, nothing I could do about it except manage my own mental health and emotions. So I taught myself how to do that. And once having done that, I realized that this was the solution to a lot of the problems that the church was trying to give us a solution to. That you didn't have to feel guilty anymore just for being human. That was now optional. And you didn't have to even feel temptation anymore, because that was now optional once you knew how to sort of like drive your brain. And suddenly I felt like, oh, you know, I don't even need the church anymore, but I'll just stay in it, you know, because it's good and I can teach other people and it's nice and stuff. The problem was that removed a lot of the motivation for me to stay in and keep coming back. And because it removed one of the things that the church and the teachings offer to people. And then after a while, I realized that it no longer had a single thing that I needed or wanted. Socially, it wasn't doing anything for me. The people that tend to join the church in Australia tend not to be a big cross-section of society. See, in somewhere like Arizona, there's a lot of Mormons, and they represent a big cross-section of society. Every economic strata, every walk of life, every ethnic group is represented. But in Australia, it's a very narrow cluster of a certain type of individual. And from my point of view, they were really boring people. I had nothing in common with. Nobody was musicians. Nobody was engineers or scientists. Oh, there were a few engineers.
Oh, really?
But nobody was, you know, creative or artistic. Nobody was really intellectual. There were no writers. Just boring people.
I find that interesting.
So I had zero sort of social joy going to church at all anymore. And so that was one more thing that just felt like I had nothing to go to. And so it was really easy just one week to just decide, nah, not going. That's it. I'm not going. Don't need it. They literally don't have anything that I need, not in this life and not in the next. And then once that happened, it's like the scales fell away and I was able to apply reasoning and logic that I had used my whole life on every other field to the question of religion. And suddenly, every piece of theological reasoning, every scripture, every teaching made perfect sense with this one little fact that made everything fall into place. And that's, it's bullshit.
It sounds like you had a much smoother transition than I did.
Well, once it got past that point, it was smooth because I'd already taught myself how to just not feel guilty if that isn't what I wanted to feel. So I didn't have that.
Yeah, see, I still deal with that even though I know it's irrational.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, because I always felt guilty growing up. Like no matter what I did, no matter, you know, if I thought I was doing good, I felt guilty. So then I was scared of dying because, you know, I'm not good enough. So I'm going to be going to freaking outer darkness or whatever.
Yeah, no, we've all lived with that. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. And because they teach you no matter what you do and how good you are.
You can't ever be good enough, right? Yeah.
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 And so, I mean, I still struggle with that a lot. So it's a work in progress.
Yeah. Well, and that's another aspect to it is I sort of saw the church is one of the pathways to my personal development and growth. And yeah, it was a rocky one. And you don't know in hindsight whether it was a necessary one or not. But for me, it was the path that I took to get where I am today. So I don't feel particularly bitter about it or angry about it. I feel like, yeah, you know, I was smart enough. I could have figured it out sooner. I'm responsible for that part of it. But I don't feel particularly bitter about it because it really shaped a lot of who I am today. And I kind of like who I turned into eventually.
Yeah. So when you had this realization, like, what did you do? Did you start, because I know I started reading books all over the place, a whole bunch of them. I mean, from Dawkins and Hitchens to Darwin and all this kind of stuff. I just started reading everything I could get my hands on. Like, did you go through any of that or?
I went through it, not reading books, because I'd already read a lot of the books and I had made excuses for them in my own mind about, oh, why that doesn't apply to this particular belief, you know, the special pleading.
Oh, okay.
Once the motivation for making that special pleading was gone, then, you know, it was like, oh, yeah, all that makes sense now. Dawkins and Stephen Jay Gould and all that stuff. I was really a big fan of Stephen Jay Gould's non-overlapping magisteria. You know, I like the judge on The Simpsons who said, science shall stay 500 yards away from religion at all times. You know, that was the slogan that for me helped make everything make sense. And I now realize it's completely wrong. There is no non-overlapping magisteria because the domain that religion occupies is zero. There is nothing that it does that cannot be investigated by science and reason. So once I realized that it was not rational, it was not logical, and in fact there was no evidence for any of it, and that essentially gods and goddesses are not real, then I started reading the atheist blogs and listening to the podcasts and things like that, and learning formally a lot of the same arguments that I had sort of come up with myself for understanding concepts like the apologetics arguments that are used and why they're wrong, where they fall down, why they're fallacious, the scientific arguments for why there is no evidence for the supernatural and what that means. For example, you know, if God exists and modifies the universe in any way whatsoever, then sort of what is the physical force that connects the supernatural to natural processes that we know about? Is it the nuclear force? Is it the electroweak force? Is it the gravitational force? Because it's got to be one of those threes, because that is all there is. And we know all the particles that there are. And there isn't anything hiding in the gaps in between. So there's no supernatural, and there is no deities tweaking the knobs behind the curtain. And once I was able to figure that out and, you know, rely on, I mean, I have a degree in physics, I have a degree in aerospace engineering, but only after I started to apply that same understanding to questions of theology, then it all started to make sense. like I said before, the unifying truth of theology is that there are no gods and goddesses at all, and there is no supernatural.
Yeah, I was going to ask which branch of science you were in, but...
Yeah, so after my mission, I came back and did a physics degree at ASU.
Okay.
And you know, my family background was in that area, too. My dad was a scientist. My mom was an educator. Between my parents' four kids, we have 8 university degrees and a PhD.
Oh, wow.
And the strange thing is that I'm the only one not in the church. With all that education.
Yeah. My dad majored in math and minored in physics and went on and got his master's in something else. And my grandpa was a chemist and worked for the FDA.
Right.
And so, I mean, like, that kind of stuff really, it runs in my blood. But I was like, no, I'm going to join the Army. So, I mean.
Oh, all right. Okay.
Oh, and I mean, it's like for a while I wanted to get a geology degree because I absolutely love Yellowstone. But then, like, working shift work, it was hard to get to school. And then I moved, and now there's a university here in town. But I mean, I was hoping to do my 2 years at, you know, a community just to save money and then transfer somewhere. But the closest one's like an hour away or something. But,
well,
and then now I'm like, the evolution is so fascinating, and I'm like, maybe evolutionary biology, but to do anything with that, you pretty much need a PhD, and I'm...
Yeah, it's a tough
not life. I really want to...
It is tough to make a living in science, it really is. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody. It's a fascinating avocation to have, but not a good vocation to have.
So what kind of reaction have you gotten from your family? Was that a difficult conversation to have, or have you had that conversation? Yeah. Or
we don't really talk about it. I mean, they see my rantings and postings on Facebook, and they ignore them, and that's fine. You know, they're not really for them. They're more for me. But we don't talk about it, and I'm not really sure that I really want to talk to them about it, because if they're happy where they are, I'm happy for them to stay there. And most of my siblings are really, really invested in the church in terms of all their social life, all their family life, their whole lives, all their lives are wrapped up in it. And yeah. I'm not really interested in disturbing that. Now, because I was living in a foreign country, divorced, separated from my son, I was a victim of parental alienation for a lot of years, remarried to a non-LDS woman, sort of just out there on my own, I don't have that same investment. And so it's perfectly fine for me to just walk away from it. No problem at all. It doesn't affect any other person.
Yeah. How has this been for your son?
The interesting thing is that he was never really indoctrinated. So
okay.
I think he left the church when he was 13 or something. And his mother didn't push him either. I mean, I don't know what her journey or story was after we separated. That was that. I just no longer care.
Yeah.
Sounds harsh, but, you know, I have reasons for, you know.
That's understandable.
It just ain't none of mine. That's all there is to it. But, yeah, he wasn't interested in it, and he and I... Now we've reconnected just recently in the last year or so, and we talk fairly regularly on Skype. He lives overseas now. And he never was indoctrinated in the church, and so he was perfectly fine with not having anything to do with it either.
Well, good for him.
But I worry a little bit about my parents. They're elderly, they're very invested in the church, and they're... To them, it's still real. And so to them, you know, this is a tragedy of eternal proportions. But we still haven't really talked about it.
Yeah, I know my dad turned 70 this last year. And, you know, mom's only a year and a half behind him. And
right.
So I haven't told them at all because, I mean, it's it's bad enough when mom calls me up and she's crying because she feels like she was a bad mom and she keeps apologizing. And with two of my sisters having left the church for other reasons, even though they still believe in God, I mean,
in some ways that's almost worse.
It's, because one of them has gone to Messianic Judaism, which I so don't understand. And then the other, like I said, has gone like sort of fundamentally and thinking that the church has gone astray from Joseph Smith's teachings and they need to go back to that. So
that's pretty scary.
So, I mean, I feel like I don't want to burden my parents with this when they're already, you know, dealing with all this other stuff. And I don't want them spending, you know, whatever years they have left thinking that they were huge failures and none of their kids are going to be there in the celestial kingdom with them and all this kind of stuff. And I'm just like, I don't know. It might not be a good reason, but I mean, that's what I got for now. I don't want to put them through it.
Yeah.
You know?
I understood that a lot. And for a long time, I didn't want to even acknowledge on Facebook that I was anything other than a true believer, but I just couldn't help myself. I just couldn't stop posting memes that were not flattering of theism and Christianity in particular. I'd like to believe that being a reasonably successful person in terms of being happy, being healthy, being fulfilled in what you do is enough for a parent to see in their offspring. And so if I'm happy and thriving and doing well and looking after myself and succeeding in the things that I want to do and try to do, I'd like to hope that that alone makes my parents see that they were good parents and that they've done as well as anyone could have and that their efforts aren't wasted.
Yeah, I'd like to think that, you know, mom can not feel so guilty about whatever it is she feels guilty about, because I've told her time and again there's nothing for her to worry about. But yeah, but I mean, oh, that's part of the burden, I think, of the church, is we're sitting here super worried about how they perceive us and just other nonsense like that.
Yeah, I've tried not to worry about it, but you can't help be concerned about the people you care about.
Yeah.
And you don't want them to suffer and you don't want them to feel bad. You can blame the church for helping people feel bad a lot, but they're not going to see it that way. I think by me living an example of a happy, fulfilled person that doesn't have a lot of issues and isn't angry and isn't bitter, that they'll see that everything's okay. Everything's great. In fact, it's better than great. It's my life is better than it has been in 20 years.
That's awesome.
So what did you do in the Army?
I was an MP, actually.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I don't know. I was feeling all discouraged with college and like all these prerequisite classes that didn't have anything to do with my major, and I wasn't doing too well because I didn't care about these classes.
Yeah.
So I felt like I was wasting my parents' money because they were paying for my tuition and everything. And I was like, well, I'll just join the Army. They'll train me. They'll pay me while they train me. And then I won't be a leech on my parents' bank account. And
and
there I went. So, oh, my goodness. And I could have done literally anything else. And I just, I'm like, no, I want to be a cop.
Okay.
And I mean, in ways I regret that now, because I'm like, like I said, I could have done anything because, you know, I was smart. I scored really, really, really well on the ASVAB, which is the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery that you have to take before you go in. And it grades you in different areas. And
and this kind of stuff to see what you're good at, so they know like what your options should be. And I mean, I scored in the 97th percentile.
Oh, wow.
That's so great. Yeah, I was like, I could have done anything. And in fact, when I got to reception, they said, well, because your GT, which is your general technical score, was so high, we're going to have you take the D-Lab, which is the Defense Language Aptitude Battery. Yeah. Okay. So it's basically, they take English words, they put foreign grammar rules on it, and then you have to tell them what these words mean with these foreign grammar rules. And I had just taken a couple semesters of Russian, and they were Russian grammar rules that they were using. So all I was right. like, oh, okay. So, I mean, I passed it first time, which from what I hear is pretty unheard of. But I was like, dang it, I should have been a linguist. I could be making bank right now. Oh, Russian was so much fun.
Oh, it's so difficult. I took 2 years of it, and I can barely say hello and goodbye.
Yeah. Здравствуйте. But, I mean, that was the only time I got a headache doing homework. Right. It would take me like an hour to do a single page, but it was so much fun. I had a great time. And then my professor was from the Ukraine, so he was filling us in on these little tiny just cultural things that you don't get other like just from the text.
Yeah.
You know, like for instance, I guess when you wish somebody luck, like we say break a leg, you know, but we don't literally mean go out and, you know, break your leg because that would suck. But, you know, it's just one of these weird phrases. But they say nipukha nipra,
which literally,
right. which, you know, literally translated neither down nor a feather.
Right. That means hit the thing but square then, on. Right.
Yeah, but then, like, he says, you have to respond a certain way or else you jinx yourself.
Oh,
so you
right.
have to respond and say, kachortu.
Okay.
Which means go to hell. So, I mean, it was fun because, you know, he was telling us little things like that, you know, and as you see, that's one of the things that stuck with me. So I'm like, yeah, I can tell people to go to hell in Russian. Okay. So, you know,
I didn't know that last part. Yeah. We were taught that first part, but not the last part.
Yeah. Yeah. You're supposed to respond that way or else you're supposedly, you know, bringing the bad juju. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, Russian culture is so steeped in superstition. And yeah, there's just so much of it. And I used to read a lot of Turgenev and Dostoevsky. And there's just so much of the superstition that's baked into the background and the language.
Yeah, I picked up a book of Russian fairy tales when I was in high school started reading them. And I mean, you think Grimm's fairy tales are dark.
No.
But I mean, I didn't get through that book because, and I mean, it was a thick book too. It had a whole bunch of them because, I mean, it was so culturally different that I had a hard time getting through it.
And yeah,
now I want to go back and read it again, but it's just interesting. It's fun learning the different stuff, but I mean, I'm fascinated by it, especially since in America, we're in such this little bubble of we're the best and everybody else sucks kind of thing. So
everybody only ever reads one book and they think they can understand it, you know, and if they'd read even a second book like that fairy tale book, they'd realize that, wow, you have very little chance of actually understanding something that was written just last century in another country, never mind 1,000 years ago in a completely different culture.
Yeah.
And so people would often say, see, I was never a biblical literalist my whole life. Our family wasn't either. It was, right, this is metaphor. This is, you know, parable.
Oh, that's interesting to me. Because, I mean, I grew up very literal about it.
Yeah. And see, that's the thing. The Mormons isn't a monolithic thing. There are literalist Mormons and there are less biblical literalist Mormons. There are more and less fundamentalist Mormons. There's all different kinds. We happen to be the kind that were sort of not biblical literalists, but we'd have arguments with other members. You know, Like, well, they would say, well, how come the Bible just can't mean exactly what it says? Well, because we have no idea what it actually says. It might mean that. It might mean something completely different. Depends on what version of the manuscript it was taken from, or what the cultural significance of these allusions in the text were for. We don't know that, so we don't really know what it means.
Yeah, and I remember a lot of that transferring to the like the political climate too, because yeah. I remember my dad saying something about, well, he can't be a Democrat and be a good member in the church.
Right, yeah, except that, well, my parents were originally Republicans, but because Republicanism, the idea of it changed to something they didn't agree with, they are now Democrats. And so, yes, there are Democrat members of the church, and they feel just as much that their religious values inform their political positions as do the conservatives.
Yeah.
And you know, my parents were the kind of people that were just absolutely relieved and delighted when the priesthood was extended to all members back in the 70s. Was it, what, 78 or something?
78, yeah.
And it was previously, that was an embarrassment to them. And so they were absolutely delighted when it changed.
I remember when I heard about that, I was completely shocked that at one time that had been a thing.
Yeah.
You know, because I was born in 81, so that was just a couple years ahead of me. But, I mean, just the idea that for...
That it used to be different.
Hundreds of years, yeah. Over 100 years, like, they weren't allowed at all, and they were treated that way. And I could not wrap my head around that. Because I was just like, well, they're people. They're just, I mean, you know,
yeah,
I was like, why not? And my mom actually told me that even when it was passed, there were a lot of members that had a hard time with it, and they like resented that.
Yeah, that's true.
And I was like, I mean, I still have a hard time understanding that. And I'm like, oh, what? So, and so many things in the church are that way, and they're so backwards, but there are so many people that hold on to it so much that yeah. they just can't come forward into, I don't know, decency.
But I think other than that one moment of progressiveness in my lifetime, I think the church has moved dramatically to the right. It's become more generally politically conservative, as has the Republican Party become more right-wing conservative. It's moved sort of off the charts in terms of how right-wing it is. It used to be more or less centrist. Now, if you're a centrist, like, you know, I'm a pretty conservative guy, but I'm socially progressive and, you know, fiscally conservative. But people would call me a liberal if they knew what I really thought about things, even though by any objective standards, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, I'd be considered pretty centrist.
Yeah, and I know with this last election and everything like that and everything that went on, I was like, because I grew up and, you know, my parents were Republicans. So when I registered to vote, I registered Republican. But with all this mess recently, I'm like, as I left the church and my opinions and stuff started to change and shift, I'm like, okay, I cannot associate myself with this anymore. But I mean, I still feel like I have this internal stigma attached to labeling myself Democrat. So I'm just like, yeah, no affiliation. So
yeah, I don't see a lot of value in those labels.
Yeah, the only thing is being able to vote in the primaries.
Right.
Because you have to be
in most
one
states.
Of these two, have to be one of these two parties in order to vote in the primaries. You know,
that's why I was registered Republican when I lived in Arizona, so that I could vote against the worst of the worst people that would be on that ballot. They'd still get elected
anyway.
Like some of the people.
Because unfortunately, it's like the worst of the worst that everybody on that base is like, yay, they're the best.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. When the church started really becoming politically active on, say, gay issues like gay marriage, and making public statements about the children of same-sex marriage couples will not be treated the same as everyone else, that really struck me. That was about the time that I was sort of not wanting to have anything to do with the church anymore. But that really crystallized it for me that, no, this is an organization that I do not want to be associated with. I do not want to be aligned with this because rationally, reasonably, it just does not make empirical sense to deny civil rights to anybody for any reason. It just is not a reasonable thing to do. And even when I had strong theistic beliefs, I didn't think that that was a reasonable thing to do.
Yeah, and like I never really thought about the gay issue and the gay marriage and that kind of stuff growing up, because I mean it never crossed my mind, and we were so I want to say us kids, we were so isolated from everyone else that it was like, well, you know, that's
it never really entered your consciousness.
Yeah. And so like I never thought of it, you know, and I only vaguely remember when Prop 8 was going through and just my parents saying, yeah, we really hope that, you know, this gets passed because it's, you know, gay marriage is bad and it's such a sin and this kind of stuff. And right. Like the more I think about it, I'm like, who freaking cares? if marriage is sanctioned by God, then get it out of the government.
Yeah, that's the one sort of libertarian streak I have, is that there is no public interest in having the government regulate our relationships. There just is no justification for that. No reason for it. There are already plenty of laws covering paternity, plenty of laws covering property and inheritance. There is no reason to have a legalized system of marriage. What is that? A government-issued license to have sex? Is that what it is? That's really what it means, or what it used to mean, back when there were laws against fornication. But there aren't even laws against that anymore. So there is literally no reason to have marriage be the subject of any law. So when people talk to me about the gay marriage, and that's a current issue in Australia, they're debating it right now.
Oh,
I say,
look,
we shouldn't be debating gay marriage. We should be debating marriage, period. Why is it in the law at all? We should just take it right out because it's nobody's goddamn business.
Yeah, the only thing that I really worry about with that is the right for the loved ones to go and see their family members, like if they're in the hospital and this kind of stuff, and being denied simply because the country or the government entity at the place they're at doesn't recognize that
they're family members. There's probably ways around that, having you submit a list of who you consider to be your family, your immediate family, and then the hospital or whoever just has to accept that on your word, rather than looking for the government to say, yep, they're married, or nope, they're not. Because even in Australia, a common law marriage of more than a year is recognized fully as though it were an actual marriage. So even if you live together, you have all the rights, all the legal responsibilities and legal status as though you had actually been married. So there's not actually any reason to have the ceremony at all.
Saves you a lot.
Yeah. There's no legal, no legal distinction between officially married and unofficially married.
Jeez, what a mess.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, the whole political landscape right now, just, so scary. I can't believe we put people like that in power.
Oh. It's.
And then, like I told Andrew, when I had him on the show, like, I'm surrounded by Trump supporters at work.
Yeah.
It's.
At least in Australia, everybody recognizes him as a complete buffoon. And I was having this Facebook conversation with somebody who doesn't directly support Trump, but is tired of everybody sort of bagging on him. And I said, look what he has done to your country. Do you realize that the people who elected him have made the country that you love the laughingstock of the entire world? It is a joke. America is an international joke right now. And so the people who voted for him owe you and me and the whole world an apology. And he was very upset by that. No, you can't. You shouldn't be asked for an apology for who you vote for. Oh, yes. Like Andrew says, elections have consequences. You guys made a mistake. You owe everyone an apology for voting for this idiot.
Oh, it's horrifying. But I saw the words grand jury floating around Facebook, and I just hope it's true. I'm just like, please let them actually get something done with that. So,
I'm not looking forward to having Pence as president either. I mean, he really is one of these, you know, Christian Taliban dominionist people who's very scary. He wants to repeal the Constitution and install a Christian Taliban style theocracy.
Yeah. But I mean, I have heard some people theorize that if a president is impeached and removed from office, that when the VP takes over, he's something of
a caretaker,
like just a figurehead, because he's not the one that was elected. And so they don't want to cooperate.
Right, we call that a caretaker president. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, he does align so much with the psychotic right now that I'm worried that they might get stuff done. But I mean, I just saw that he wants to institute government-wide gay conversion chalk like he did in Indiana. And I'm just like, maybe we should chalk him into being gay.
Someone was talking about a stupid conversion therapy. If they have that, then shouldn't we have stupid conversion therapy? I said, yeah, they tried that, but Betsy DeVos is trying to get rid of that too.
Oh, no. Oh, it's... Oh, my gosh. Such a disaster. But on that cheerful note...
we need to try to stay positive.
All right. So,
let
me see.
Rational.
Yeah. When you had first started talking to me there in the little Facebook chat, you said you and your son do a science podcast.
Yeah, we just for fun. Nobody listens to it, but it's just for us. We have conversations about science and science fiction, and we call it the Explain It to Me podcast. He explains things to me that I'm too old to understand, and I explain things to him that I happen to know because I've been around so long. And yeah, we just have these conversations about science. It's a lot of fun. So that's it. Explain It to Me on Facebook. It's on YouTube is where it's hosted.
Okay. Yeah. We'll put a link to that up and
sure.
Maybe get you a couple hits.
Okay.
So. But yeah, this has been a fascinating conversation. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it has. So I appreciate it. Hearing you.
Yeah, thank you so much for reaching out. And
you're welcome.
Absolutely. It's been fun.
Well, so. I hope it's going to be a benefit to somebody out there. And you can't feel hard on yourself if in your 20s or 30s you leave the church and decide that it was no good. Because look at me. You know, I'm smart and I've had all this education, and yet it took me 50 years to figure it out. And so... Yeah, it's really hard. I don't judge poorly anybody who doesn't find their way out of it.
Yeah, it just, I mean, everybody's life journey takes them a different way, and it takes them different times, different instances to circle around and figure out what they're doing. So
yeah, and wherever you are right now is just fine.
Right now, it's mainly let me deal with my anxiety and stuff and get myself functioning like a normal person. So, all right. Well, thank you for coming on, and
thank you. Best of luck with everything.
All right. You too.
I want to thank you for joining us. If you like what you hear, please consider supporting the show on Patreon at patreon.com/doubtingdogma or leave a review on iTunes. You can follow the show on Facebook at facebook.com/doubtingdogma or on Twitter at doubtingdogma. The intro music was written and performed by Marissa Alexa McCool and was used with her permission.